Hello, and welcome to After Talk Live. I'm Lisa Bogatin, co-founder of After Talk. We're www.aftertalk.com, which is a grief and interactive bereavement website where you can write to your deceased loved ones and share, if you wish. Today's show is titled Children as Survivors of Suicide. This is part two. Our guests today bring a plethora of experience and credentials to this interview. I'm thrilled to have Mandy Zucker, MSW, Grief Recovery Therapist and Program Director of Imagine. It's a center for coping and loss, and they're based in Westfield, New Jersey. Also today, we have Dr. Lou Sabatini, a Long Island-based counseling psychologist specializing in bereavement. He's also the author of Bereavement Counseling in a School Setting. Lastly, yes, Dean, my friend and my co-founder, Larry Lynn's wife, Lynn is here today because she is the mother of two kids that whose father died by suicide. So she brings a unique perspective as well. So let's jump in. Here goes. This applies to you and Mandy and Lou. What do the kids share about kind of going back to school after this happens? You know, what do they... are they coached what to say to their teachers, to their classmates? I know we had spoken that sometimes there's bullying, and you know, there's a lot of things to anticipate.
I would just say one of the things I thought helped my kids is I was just open about it. Someone asked what happened to my husband. Yeah, he suicided. I made them aware of what happened, and it was never something we didn't talk about. And I let them own it, because if they owned it, no one could.
It was real.
Mm-hmm. Well, no, that no one could. If you hide something, if you have something wrong with you, or you feel there's something wrong with you, and you're afraid someone else is going to see it, then that can hurt you. But if you just come out there and say, "This is me," you know, I whatever, I don't like the color of my hair, or whatever it is. If you're open about it, my husband died by suicide. That's it. That's what happened. And I tell people, I tell patients freely, and you'd be amazed how many people's relatives have committed suicide or have had suicide or died by suicide. And we'll tell you about it, but won't otherwise. A lot of people's family members have died by suicide.
And I think a great thing to do with your family, you know, once you've had a conversation with your kids and you are sort of getting ready to go face the public again, to talk to the kids about how are we going to talk, you know, to friends and when things come up. And you can do some role-playing and rehearsing with them about what to do if somebody's teasing you or bullying you. You know, there are some sort of stock phrases that kids might feel comfortable saying. So you can sort of plant them and let the kids practice them. You know, if somebody says, I
What's an example, Mandy?
Yeah.
Mandy,
like,
what would be an example?
You know, like somebody can tease you, right, and say, you know, your dad killed himself because he didn't want to live with you anymore or something. And a kid can say back to them, well, you know, you can think that if you want to. It's not what I think, but if that's what you want to think, you can think that. And that sort of ends the conversation, you know, let them have their feeling and I can have my feeling. Or you could say, you know, if somebody's asking you questions and you don't want to talk about it, you could just say that, you know, I don't really want to talk about that right now, but I'll let you know if I'm ready. So those kinds of things, you can prepare kids to respond when kids talk to them about it if they don't want to talk about it.
Lou, let me ask you. You've written a book, Bereavement Counseling in the School Setting. On how does that? What are your thoughts about how that hits your the age group you're referring to?
Yeah, I think the school could have a very important role here in helping the youngster. First of all, important for the school before the child comes back to the counselor or someone to call the home and just to find out the kind of information that's important so that the school isn't saying something different than the student is saying. Also, you know, students report that the first day back after experiencing a loss is probably the most difficult, especially in a case like, you know, death by suicide, because they're being constantly bombarded all day long with kids, teachers, well-meaning adults that are trying to express their condolences and so forth. And sometimes it might be helpful for the school, for instance, to tell the faculty that instead of trying to pay condolences on their first day back and making the student feel overwhelmed, why not just say, welcome back, we missed you, and then maybe few days later, pay more formal, condolence message. The kids say that that first day back is just so overwhelming for them, and it just adds their anxiety and to their sorrow. So sometimes, if the school can dial it back a little bit, and also be very careful of, sometimes schools have traditions like you lower the flag to half mast if there's a death of a, a student or, staff member. Very careful that if, when you have death by suicide, that be treated similarly. You don't want the value of a person to be demeaned because of the way they died. And sometimes schools make judgment calls on that, for instance.
That's lousy.
I'll just give you an example. Schools are very worried about the contagion effect. If we pay a tribute to the student, are we then glorifying the act? And it's very scary for schools, and it's very important to try to separate the act from the person themselves. And I worked in one school, I think, who handled very well students who, for instance, wanted to pay tribute to the student who died by suicide at their talent show or in their school newspaper or in their student bulletin board were allowed to do that. But in public functions like a school board meeting or some kind of awards assembly, the school refrained really from saying anything. They just had like a 60-second of silence in respect for the student without doing anything more. So separating, the act from the person is important.
It's very, very sweet. I didn't realize the school would be that involved with actually lowering the flag, or even I get with a student kind of memorial, but not necessarily with a parent.
A parent memorial meant more of a student memorial, right?
Yeah. Well, you know what? I think we just are coming full circle to the stigma that's attached to suicide that's different than any other kind of death, which is, kind of the reoccurring theme with suicide. What if a child had, I just wanted to go back to the kid again. How do you respond to a child who feels abandoned? And I'm sure Wendy can speak about that because it's probably been, 27 years of ongoing, abandonment on some level. And that, the deceased parent, did they not really love them? Do you hear that, Mandy? Do you hear that, Lou?
Yeah. I mean, the thing that I would say is that if a child is telling you, that they do feel abandoned, I think right there, pat yourself on the back because they feel comfortable talking with you. So you already, you're a step ahead because you have some trusted adult that somebody is talking to you. So what we want to do is listen to them. Lots of times, we'll hear parents that will say, my child's talking about suicide, but he's only doing that to get attention. Yes, that's exactly right. They're doing it to get attention. So they need attention. Pay attention. I think it's great when kids can come to you with really difficult, painful sort of feelings that they might feel ashamed of. And what a great opportunity to let kids know that they're, wonderful, trusted adults in their life that are here to support them.
I think
I'm lucky to make it. Go ahead, Bill.
That's true. Just a student being able to verbalize is really important. But I think also to provide an explanation that sometimes a person's illness, mental illness, person's pain is so extreme that it actually trumps a person's love for others. And I think that's the part that's hard to understand about suicide. How could someone do something like that when they have loved ones around trying to help them? And that's the part that is hard to understand because their depth of pain is so extreme that we can't even relate to it. And that, I think, has to be the message, that sometimes the illness and the pain is so extreme that it just, it supersedes the love that a person had for his family.
Right. It clouds their judgment. Right.
And Wendy, and how? What would you say on that topic?
I think what Lou said was right on target. That I understood to the degree which my husband was in psychic pain. And he was having an anxious depression, and it was palpable. I mean, I had a moment of anxiety here and there in life, and it's a horrible emotion to experience. He had it nonstop. And it went on for intensely, you know, it was going on for probably years, but it went on intensely for the past few months of his life. And he said to me, the only way he can get it to stop is to think about ending his life. And that was despite seeing a psychiatrist 3 times a week. And I mean, in retrospect, yes, he should have been hospitalized and all sorts of other things should have gone on. But that's, you know, that's hindsight, because I honestly didn't think he was actually going to kill himself. You know,
did your kids, you know, have, you know, feelings of saying, you know, daddy, you know, decided to leave, he must not have loved me? Did you get that early on, or as they got older?
I think my daughter at 4 and a half felt it in a very almost nonverbal way. It was overwhelming feeling that she had, and from her face when I told her what happened, you know, that she was crushed by it. You know, something changed in my daughter forever, you know, in her face. And it took years till I saw a different person back, but she's been changed by it. And my son has too, and that's the thing that I think you can understand things, you can best cope with them and deal with them, and you go on with life. But there are things that happen to your life that changes you forever. And I don't think you can undo some of the effects that a suicide of a parent or a loved one has on people. It's a profoundly life-altering experience for those that are left behind. And you learn to adjust to it, and you learn to, you're changed by it. You're not the same person because of it. But there's no way of kind of whitewashing the experience of, I mean, to this day, all the feelings I have, no matter how much my cerebral cortex can analyze them, I still have the same feelings I've always had about my husband's death. And I suspect my kids will always have these kind of feelings. I think feelings are something that you don't eradicate. You learn to think about them in a way that allows you to cope with them. But they don't go away. I can't tell you that the feelings I have about my husband's death ever went away. I still feel the sorrow, the shame, the woulda, shoulda, coulda feelings, and despite all my logic and being in a position and everything else, some things don't eradicate some kind of a loss, and that's part of the human experience, I guess. I mean, it's just what it is. I don't know whether Lou or Mandy have a comment about that.
Forever present. Yeah. Forever present. Here's a question for Mandy and Lou, and certainly Wendy, chime in. Resources. What can we tell our audience today what can we share? How to find resources? Mandy, how do people find Imagine? Or grief and bereavement organizations, and where do they start? Somebody died by suicide. Okay, they wake up the next day. What do you do?
Yep. There's a lot of resources out there, actually. There's the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. The website is ASSP.org. They've got a lot of great resources on there. Obviously, if you're concerned about someone's immediate safety, your own or someone else, you're going to call 911 right away. But there's other hotlines. There's the Suicide Prevention Hotline. Their number is 800-273-TALK, T-A-L-K.
Mm-hmm.
There's the National Alliance for Grieving Children. They have a website called childrengrieve.org, which has tons of great resources and lots of support groups that people can find, like ours, on their website as well.
I would also like to add, there's an organization called the Dougie Center out in Portland, Oregon, and they've been around for a number of years, and they have excellent resources. I recently attended a conference, and they had a book from the Dougie Center called After a Suicide Death, an Activity Book for Grieving Children. And it was really excellent. It was a nice resource.
Yep, they're on the NAGC website as well. And Imagine is actually trained by the Dougie Center model, so we use the same model as they do.
Interesting.
One last thing I'd like to mention for the parent who has a very young child, 3, 4, 5 years old, who doesn't understand the permanence of death, there's a book that was written a number of years ago that's really excellent. The title of the book is The Fall of Freddie the Leaf by Leo Biscoglia, and he explains death to young children as we would understand the seasons, you know, like spring, summer, fall, and winter. And he does an excellent job, and I've worked with parents who have used that book, and they said it's very effective in explaining death to young children.
Yep.
So I imagine there are plenty of books out there that are a good handful that would also be something to share with kids at different ages. I'm sure many different ages that books are written. Well, I have to say, this interview has been very interesting today. Yes, Larry, do you have more to share?
Andy. Yeah, just one other thing I want to say is that as just a person who's had a family member commit suicide, but also as a person, as a physician, and seeing other people, is that our mental health care in this country is very, very poor in terms of, in general, the availability of mental health care, the stigma.
You make a very good point.
And that I think that what needs to change, if people don't want to lose people by suicide, is that the dialogue of opening up mental illness as something that needs to be addressed in our society, that has to be addressed in terms of availability of care for those people, of treatment for the people, and openness about discussion about things that perhaps in our culture we feel that we are too ashamed or shouldn't bring out and talk about or fund. I think that that's ultimately what's going to help to change this situation for people.
Yeah,
Wendy, and unfortunately, if you look at over the last 10 years after the Great Recession, all the budget cuts, we're actually losing funding for mental health programs, which is really helping the situation.
Yes, absolutely, and right on target.
The mental health programs specifically, are they statewide, Lou, or are they national?
Mostly statewide local programs, yeah. Yeah, the states are cutting budgets back, and they're cutting it from the areas where the people don't have a voice. The people who are mentally ill don't have a voice in government, in a sense, you know. So it's easy to cut back in those areas.
You know, in New York City, we all remember when all of a sudden every homeless person was somebody who had schizophrenia, was just let out of, because of this, you know, I think Lindsay had done it, and just removed everyone from hospitals and put them back out on the street if they had schizophrenia. You know, there was a tremendous cost saving supposedly to the public, which was not real in terms of what actually happens. But, you know, just funding by people's health insurance. Some people have very limited coverage for mental illness in their health insurance. Prisons now, they're starting to address the fact that many people in prisons are mentally ill, and there's no treatment or coverage for that.
Yeah, they're saying as much as 60% of prison populations, but to correct the record, it wasn't Lindsay, it was Governor Hugh Carey, who to save money closed all the state psychiatric, or many of the state psychiatric hospitals, and eliminated those beds on the theory that people would be better served in the community, but then gave no funding. I also wanted to say that fundraising for anything that has to do with mental illness in the private sector is extremely difficult. I've done this professionally, and it's one of the hardest challenges in fundraising because of the stigma attached to mental illness. Very few wealthy families self-identify as prospects for giving to mental health organizations. There are three national organizations, but they, like NAMI is a very famous one, but they all face a real uphill climb on private fundraising, and as Lou and Wendy pointed out, government sources have been tenuous at best when it comes to mental health.
Larry, why is it? Because people are stigmatized and don't want to give money towards it, or what?
Yeah, rich people don't want to admit that they have defective children. There's a lot of peer pressure on them to have perfect children, you know, to go to the best schools, get into the Ivy Leagues. And, you know, you and I know some very wealthy people, one very wealthy couple, where you know, the father has a schizophrenic son, and they don't give a penny to mental illness issues while they give away tens of millions to other causes. And there's a lot of that. In fact, Glenn Close and her sister did a public service announcement campaign about 3 years ago about stigma and getting more about it. Was focused mostly on depression, but of course depression is, you know, probably the lead cause of suicide.
So let me just say,
She had been supporting suicide because of her death of her husband by suicide, and
Joan Rivers, right?
Yeah.
I hope that programs, Larry and Wendy, I hope that programs like this bring this conversation to a fore, or certainly may shift things. I want to thank everyone for tuning in to After Talk Live today. You can see this interview on our website, which is www.aftertalk.com. You can listen to all the past live interviews at www.blogtalkradio.com. And let me just say, Lou and Mandy and Wendy, thank you so much. I'm really grateful for the information that you've shared with our audience today. I know it will help those who are suffering and get to the next step, handle what's on their plate, and shift and heal from grief. So thank you very much, Lou and Mandy, for joining us today, and Wendy, and you know, for our wonderful audience. So signing off until the next radio, Mandy and Lou will all speak soon.
Terrific.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.